Hello, everyone. This is the Farms for Tomorrow podcast, and I'm your host, Cliff Scholes. We're here today with Eric Campy, an organic no-till farmer in southeast Michigan. Eric founded the Ann Arbor Seed Company in 2012, and he is now part owner of the Green Things Farm Collective, along with four other farmers. Welcome, Eric.
Hi, Cliff. Thanks. It's good to be here.
So let's get right into it. You started your own seed company in 2012. Can you tell us a little about your background and why seeds? Why was that the thing you were attracted to?
So I didn't come from a farming family. I was an engineer a lifetime ago, and I wasn't satisfied with sitting at a desk for so long. I wanted to work more with my hands. I wanted to work outside more. And I had a craving to have a more environmental career. And I started volunteering on farms. I was living in Colorado at the time. And then I started working on farms. I just sort of let it become a slippery slope. I found that I enjoyed the work. And I started farming at Abundanza Organic Seeds and Produce. And I was there originally because they were an organic produce farm, which is something I was interested in. But they were also a seed-saving farm. And they were doing seeds on their own label. But they were also contracting with Seeds of Change. So anyway, that was my first exposure to seed saving, and I just found it to be mesmerizing and beautiful. You get to see the full life cycle of the crop. You get to farm kind of at a slower pace, since the crops tend to be a full season. Some produce crops can be very quick. You're in and out and on to the next. And that's pretty rare with seed crops. Usually it's sort of a longer game, and that lets you get to see pieces of the life cycle of a crop that not every produce grower routinely sees. And I just found that to be really beautiful. And so when my wife and I moved back home to Michigan, where we grew up, I thought it might be a time to see if I can start seed saving on my own here. That was the beginning of Ann Arbor Seed Company, which has sort of carried me into the Green Things Farm Collective and today.
I see. So every farmer's first task is to find a piece of land to farm. And how did you manage that?
I had it easier than most. Land access can be a real challenging for folks, especially if you don't have a lot of resources, if you're not inheriting it from a family, if you're not rich. I got pretty lucky because I was almost immediately connected with a family that had a little extra land and were looking to host a farmer on that property almost immediately when returning to Ann Arbor. It was really a whirlwind for me. So we're moving back home and we're looking for apartments. And a friend of mine takes me to this pop-up brunch that was called Selma Cafe. I mean, it was hosted at a community member's house and it was a nonprofit. It was using the proceeds to kickstart other farming operations. And it was the sexy thing of the moment. Like, oh, you got to go to Selma Cafe. You're going to get a great meal. You see really great people. It's just fun. So a friend took me to that and I met Jeff McCabe there, who was one of the hosts. And he pointed me at Steve and Madeline Theory, who were friends of theirs, who were my landlords for 8 years, I believe, my farm landlords. And so it was really, really felt wonderful to be so quickly embraced, moving back to a community and stumbling upon a small amount of land to farm almost immediately. And so that was the land that I grew seeds on for Ann Arbor Seed Company for those years.
So you also grew vegetables for market on the property that you obtained that way?
Yes, absolutely. I started with 100% focus on seeds. And as I gained more experience working that land, I started doing more produce side by side because you really can, they benefit from each other. But also that's just a lot to manage a farm. So I was trying to take it one step at a time if I could. But yeah, we did grow produce there as well.
It's an interesting part of the story that community was a theme right from before you even started, really. You met some people at a locally food-themed event, and then it grew from there.
Yeah, absolutely. Community is critical. It's central. You know, there's a lot of different ways to be a farmer, and the small farms that I know tend to be very community-centered because they're directly marketing. And so you want to know your customer and you want to be a part of your community that you're serving. You want them to know you and know why it's worth cooperating with that farm or supporting that farm. If I was just selling to the corn mill as a commodity crop, knowing my neighbor, I think would still be important, but I'm not trying to sell to them. For these small farms, you know, these are CSA farms that are doing community supported agriculture. They need to be integrated in their community. It's in the name. And, you know, these are the customers that you're selling to. And these are the people that are going to say, oh, have you talked to so-and-so chef? Or have you considered, I don't know, such and such idea?
Local food has kind of a cachet. It's definitely developed over the last few years as a matter of public awareness. There's local food restaurants that specialize in serving things that have been grown locally. And there's, in Ann Arbor anyways, there's also even local grocers who aggregate the produce from a lot of our area farms and make them available through their own storefronts. So how does local seed fit into the whole local food picture?
You know, I think in a lot of ways, seed saving, unfortunately, has become sort of a niche, or it's uncommon these days. I think it's actually really gaining in popularity in the last few years. But if you take a longer view, we've been losing the genetic diversity of the seed, of the produce seed that's available to us for generations. As seed companies have done the get big or go home philosophy, the consolidation. And so it's left us with just a small handful of mega giants that are operating as a seed industry. And it used to be more commonplace for home gardeners and small farms to save some percentage of their seeds. And that's become less and less common. And that's a part of why I wanted to do seed saving. On one hand, it makes a lot of sense to consolidate seeds because they ship well, they're lightweight. And so if you want to plop one company down in the middle of the country and mail your seeds out to everyone and contract out the growing to only the regions in the country that are most suited, you can find the easiest, most profitable way to grow the crops and then just be the only game in town and distribute it to everyone. I mean, boy, that makes a lot of, I guess, business sense. But when you start thinking about how important diversity is in our food, it doesn't make sense for us to just have a few big companies. And diversity is both in the perspective of the seed saver and the region that it was grown in and the biology of the seed. Ooh, there's a little bit to unpack there. So I would say every time you save seed from, you know, the biggest operations to the smallest hand gardener, you're making a selection. You're choosing which biology you'd like to save and pass on to the next generation for that seed crop. You're deciding, oh, this is the most vigorous plant. This is the most flavorful plant. This is the one that suits my farm and it suits my culinary use. And so I'm choosing this. And that selection is an influence on the genetics of that plant. And over time, these varieties will adapt based on those selections. That's selective breeding. And so if we have very few companies that are doing this, you have very few perspectives. We basically have a small number of large profit-driven companies that are supplying large profit-driven farms. And not that profit is evil, but if that's the primary perspective is to satisfy your shareholders, flavor is going to be lower on the priority list. But if this is someone in their own garden saving seed for their favorite tomato plant, flavor is going to be really at the top of the list. Vigor and productivity is going to be at the top of the list. And just like their use, like, oh, this is the one I use for my famous pasta sauce recipe. That's my tomato. And I think that's really a beautiful thing. And I think that's why seeds can be really complicated, but they can also be really simple. Anyone can be a seed saver and anyone can have that power to just say, okay, I'm joining this conversation between human growers and the plant species that we depend on to live.
That's a big picture consideration, and it also does inspire people, I think, or I hope it does, to connect with local seed producers like yourself, because potentially, anyway, what you're saying is that local seeds can be locally adapted to local conditions, and you're also along the way building relationships with the people that you're buying seeds from, building community locally as you do. So that's a beautiful vision. And then you went forward and became a farmer. How did your practice grow over that time? And what worked?
So I started off small, like you ought to, I guess, the advice that no one takes. But the land that I rented in 2012 was 3/4 acre. And I wasn't even attempting to farm the entire property in my first few seasons. I quickly realized, not as quickly as I'd like to in hindsight, I started to realize that water was my challenge on this property. And so I had gotten my first real exposure to farming in Colorado, where it was pretty dry. And we were able to run irrigation, but it was a whole different game. And here in Michigan, where the water falls from the sky, the reality of the land that I ended up with was a heavy clay with a high water table and not really an obvious drainage. And so for the first time, I was seeing water as a problem of having too much of it. And so I struggled with that for quite a number of years. I think that was the big issue of learning to farm once again in Michigan.
So how does that show up? If a farmer is having issues, what did you see that's like, uh-oh, I've got to do something about this? And is there something that you did that might help other farmers who are facing similar issues?
Yeah, it hits you over the head like a mallet when you have a big rainstorm and your crops are like literally underwater. But it also gets you in subtler ways. If you have a part of your field that has frequent poor drainage events or frequently has a high water table, you end up with an anaerobic zone in your soil or a shallower soil. You could have soil that should be 6 inches or 1 foot deep, but that low 6 inches of it is always wet. And that can be exacerbated by compaction. And I think it affects the general soil biology of that. So that ground can dry out after the storm is over, but is still stunted. You know, and I went through the process of getting a soil test. I made sure to get a soil test on the best parts of the farm, and then specifically a soil test on the worst parts of the farm. It was a small farm, so these best and worst parts are near each other. And the soil test came back the same, leading me to guess it really had to do with this water issue. The mineral component of the soil wasn't different, but the biological part was different because this low wet spot was just getting choked out through anaerobic conditions periodically.
In our introduction, I described you as a no-till organic farmer. How did no-till practices fit into your solution for the problems that you faced on that piece of land?
I started exploring with some of the techniques that are involved in no-till organic farming pretty early on, before I even really knew that's what I was doing. And so I guess to be clear, I'm following a no-till method that is often called the deep compost mulch method. And you can see that described. There's several books. I know Andrew Meffert has a book and Daniel Mays has a book. There's a great podcast that Farmer Jesse does, the No-Till Market Gardener podcast. Folks can learn more of those details. But it uses several techniques. You're smothering weeds or controlling weeds with occultation or a dark tarp or a silage tarp. And you're using an applied compost as a deep mulch to be a barrier between your soil and the sunlight to protect it from the sun, the wind, and the rain, but also to block weeds, to keep weeds below them, and as a medium to transplant or to direct sow your seed. It encourages the use of a broad fork if anything is needed for loosening the soil, something that's less disruptive than tillage. The idea is to not break up the soil structure, disturb the existing biology in your soil, and to not bring the weed seed bank back up to the surface, to keep your soil covered at all times. I was using pieces of this no-till strategy before I even knew what it was. I didn't have a scale that it made much sense for me to invest in a large tractor. And so it was hard for me to do tillage anyway, and I was already looking for alternatives. I had to hire it out, and the timings were awkward. Someone had to come in, and that space was hard to get to. It was just mechanically difficult for me to till. And so when I learned that you can transition from weeds, or better yet, a cover crop, using a black plastic that's temporarily applied to smother out the sunlight and kill those plants. That was really helpful to me. You know, I can drag a tarp over an area. I can wait an amount of time, kind of depending on how warm we are, what part of the summer we're in. And then when I remove it, it will be clean of weed life. And when I first was hearing about that, I was worried that I was going to pull a tarp and see this like baked, scorched earth desert. But what you really end up seeing is this beautiful, not overly wet, but sort of moist soil. There's earthworms right at the top. The cover crop or weeds that you smother, they're dead, but they look like straw. They're not overly cooked. And so that was encouraging. And so I started moving more and more into these practices.
In 2019, there was an enormous amount of rain in the early spring, and it was dubbed the no plant spring for many farmers in the country. And farmers were tallying up their losses due to the fact that they couldn't get their seed in the ground because the ground was too wet. So how did your soil respond to that situation?
Yeah. 2019, the spring of 2019 was gnarly. It was wet. I think we got something like 25 days of rain in May. And a lot of those were like 1 inch, and some of those were like 3 inch. It was really wet. And so at this point, I had built my farm into permanent raised beds, and I had made an intentional lower pathway that sloped the water where it wouldn't be destructive. So that was helpful, but I still had heavy clay soil that didn't like being that wet. The winter preceding 2019, I was thinking, I'm going to lean into this no-till idea that I've been reading about. You get all the books, you got all your field plans and all your intentions. And then honestly, I was scared because I still couldn't wrap my head around how to completely replace all the services that tillage does with these no-till techniques. And I was going to chicken out. I don't know what I was going to do, but I was ready to chicken out. And then we got rain, and then more rain, and then more rain, and then more rain. And didn't matter how scared I was, tillage was not an option. You know, the implement would have just sunk in the muck and then stayed there. So I moved into the practice of applying mulch and planting into it. And so the condition of my field in, let's rewind to sort of March, early April, it had been cover crop preceding, like a winter kill cover crop. But those winter kill cover crop, what happens is, you know, the winter kills them. And then before your spring planting date, you know, there's like this perfect bed of winter killed cover crop and nothing else, but at the wrong time, like in February. And then by the time you're ready to do your spring planting, you've got those early spring weeds, like chickweed, other kind of cold hardy grasses and mints. And they're not hardy, they're not established yet, but they're there. And if you were to try and just plant among them, they'd just dominate. That wasn't an option. I knew putting a tarp over it then wouldn't be very effective because it's quite cold then. If you've ever tried to tarp cool weather crops too early in the season, you pull the tarp off and they're just sort of blanched, but still alive. So I rolled out paper or cardboard, which was an option at my scale. And then I put about an inch of compost over top that. And I did the pathways and wood chips, mostly just to help the wheelbarrow get in. And then I was transplanting my spring greens through that layer of compost with paper or cardboard mulch under it. And it worked beautifully. That thin layer of paper or cardboard was enough that none of those early weeds were able to survive. They couldn't push up through it. But coming from above, anything I transplanted or even something I direct sowed, it had the power to push down through it from above. And so, you know, we were either troweling through it or if we had enough material, just letting the plant establish and then grow through it on its own. And so this was a year when all the big boys, the big agronomic farms, couldn't get their machines in, not a chance. And then my peers, other small farms, they also weren't able to meet their spring planting dates, but we could work rain or shine. And lettuce in particular seemed to really appreciate basically growing in compost. And I admit that it's materials heavy and it was tiring because I didn't have the infrastructure in place at that time to move these materials. I was moving them with a wheelbarrow. But it really opened my eyes that sort of getting bullied by the weather in the spring, it was nice to have a way around that.
You're now cultivating with your farm partners, with the Green Things Farm Collective. You're working a bigger piece of land. I'm wondering about the scalability of no-till and anything that you could share with beginning farmers or established farmers who are looking to incorporate this practice.
As a small-scale market grower, I've really appreciated the no-till techniques. And I think for the farms that are in the 1 acre, 2 acre range, I think it's almost a no-brainer. It really works well with these human-scaled farms or farms that want to be very square foot intensive. I think there's a lot of practical use for that. But now, like you're saying, Cliff, I've joined with some other growers and we're doing about 3.5 acres of vegetable field production. And we have some large hoop houses, and we're looking to grow. We're looking to increase that size a little bit. I think it still is possible to move things around with wheelbarrows at that scale, but we're using machinery at this scale, and I don't think it changes the appeal to no-till at all. We have a lot of pathway. Our pathway is 30-inch, and our bed spacing is 30-inch. So that means that our farm is 50% pathway. And when I first saw that, I was like, oof, that's a lot of pathway. And that's to get the big tractor tire down to fit the machine down the row. But as I came to see it, I actually kind of appreciate it now. When you have full-grown crops in the swing of the season, it gives them more breathing room, gives them more space. Think of not just the seedling when it's first planted, but the full-grown cauliflower or trellised tomato. Having that extra path space isn't so bad. Since we're doing a no-till method, we're not ruining these paths every year and remaking them every year. We're making them once and we're maintaining them. And so we're only adding fertility to the beds and we're only really focusing on the beds. So while it does feel like a big waste at first, I think it works out pretty well. So that lets us get machinery in. And so we have a John Deere front loader tractor that can use PTO implements. And we have a couple of other tractors that can pull equipment through the field. One of the challenges with no-till, at least at first, is material handling. And so I mentioned those big pathways. Those are all wood chipped, and they're all wood chipped pretty deeply. And so we had to move all those wood chips. Our growing space, we're mulching that with compost, and we're doing that quite regularly. And sometimes we're doing an inch, but occasionally we're doing more than that. And sometimes we're on top of that compost, we're putting other mulches. We can source a leaf mulch or something else to just keep that soil as covered as possible. But it all adds up to a lot of material handling. But with the equipment, you can find ways to make that farm more and more efficient. So first we were shoveling material out of the bucket of the tractor. So the tractor would drive in reverse down the beds and you'd have about a yard of material in the bucket and two people would pull it out with shovels. You can get a skill set about that and you can do it pretty well. And we did a huge amount with that method, but it eventually became clear that we can optimize further. Quickly, we learned that we can use a dump trailer with a baffle installed in the middle. So it's just a board that was screwed in the middle. And so when the dump trailer did its normal dumping mechanism, that baffle blocked wood chips so they would only fall off in the sides behind the wheels. And we were using that to help us apply wood chips in the pathway. And we like that, but it's a little messier than we'd like. We found it's really important to keep the wood chips in the path and the compost in the bed. And if you have a few inches where it's sort of fudgy gray area, it's sort of both, it's not ideal.
This is a recent innovation that you developed with other farmers at the Green Things Farm Collective, correct?
Absolutely. And it's the kind of innovations that I couldn't have done on my own. I'm mechanically minded enough to get myself into trouble, but we have some team members that are actually really skilled. And that's the benefit of working with a team is we all have our strengths and weaknesses. And having someone that, you know, a puzzle that I would scratch my head at over a year and then make some expensive mistakes, someone else can look at that and be like, oh, you just need this and that. And I'm like, thank you very much. Let's do that then. One of our farming neighbors was exploring using a manure spreader. And they were using it actually to apply their wood chips. But we started using a very small compost spreader. And normally the way these work is they just fling manure out the back. And we built a wooden baffle over the back of it. And so instead of flinging it every which way, it hit the baffle and then dropped right on our 30-inch bed. And so now, instead of having three people, one person driving the tractor and two people working shovels, one person can pull this single implement and spread compost. And it does a nice job. Or if we're really in a pinch, we can have two people, one person running compost back and forth with the loader, and another person driving a second tractor pulling this spreader. And in that mechanism, we can add compost really quickly. As fast as I can get compost out to the field, we can spread it. So when we're doing a no-till bed flip, we've got our previous crop harvested and our bed's clean, and we're going to add our amendment, we're going to do our broad fork, and we're going to add another inch of compost, and then we can plant that day.